have Yuwon Won visiting us today. Won is a graduate student at Johns Hopkins, finishing a PhD with Oleg Chernyshov. He's also a graduate fellow at KITP in Santa Barbara, and he'll be visiting us on the whole week.
Early, yeah.
Right, so his office is 267, if I
yes,
remember correctly.
I believe so.
Feel free to stop by and talk to him. Today he's going to tell us about some Z2 spin liquid storing in a couple of labs.
Thanks, Luis. So first of all, I'd like to say that it's really a great pleasure to visit this wonderful place and to give a presentation about my own research here. So as you can see that I'm going to talk about our recent work on the phenomenological theory of Z2 spin liquid in Kagome spin 1/2 Heisenberg antiferromagnet. So our work was published this year. So if you are interested in the details, I invite you to read about it in this paper. It's all there. I guess there's really no need to review the spin liquid history and all those things, but I guess it really never hurts to remind ourselves what their spin liquids are and why people care about them. So I'd like to start my introduction with a little bit the history or pseudo history. So in the early days of condensed matter physics, there was a debate. The debate was centered on whether it is possible to have antiferromagnetism in real materials. So basically, I think the whole controversy can be understood by just looking at this simple two-spin Hamiltonian. So here, the J is the exchange interaction and is positive. And S1 and S2 are the spin vectors for two neighboring spins. So Louis Nell, who was an experimentalist, he solved this problem from pure classical picture. So where he assumed that the spin quantum number S is big. So from a classical picture, we know that the classical ground states are those states where the spins are pointing antiparallel to each other. So if you so this is the basic building block, and if you extend this into a two-dimensional plane, then you pretty much get a state like this. So the blue spins, the spins on those sides are all pointing up, and it's neighboring. So first of all, the square lattice is decomposing into sublattices, and on the spins on different sublattices are pointing in opposite directions. However, Lev Landau doesn't believe in this kind of order, which was known as antiferromagnetism. Because if you really solve this problem for a pure quantum spin, which we have spin 1/2 quantum spin number, then we know that the ground state is simply a singlet. So it's not magnetic. There is no symmetry, spin symmetry breaking. And if you generalize this picture to two dimension, then we have a state which breaks the lattice translational symmetry, but it preserves the spin rotational symmetry. So from those two complementary point of views, well, we could have two possibilities. One possibility is that we have antiferromagnetism, and the other possibility is simply nowadays known as a valence bound solid. So today we know that for Heisenberg model on square lattice, the ground state is actually just this antiferromagnetic state. So interestingly, there is a third possibility, because we know that in an antiferromagnet, we break the spin rotational symmetry and also the lattice symmetry. And in a valence bound solid, we doesn't break spin rotational symmetry, but we do break translational symmetry of the lattice. So the question is whether it is possible to preserve both symmetries, preserve the spin and lattice symmetry. So it turns out it's possible. And such a state is known as a resonating valence bound state. So where can we find such a state? So actually, we can find in those frustrated magnets. So a simple example of frustrated magnets is simply a triangle of spins. So let's say if we put anti-ferromagnetic exchange interaction between neighboring spins, and we ask what is the ground state, then from the, if we take the classical picture, we see that if we make those two spins parallel, anti-parallel to each other, then it is impossible to arrange the third spin in such a way that is both is anti-parallel to both spins. So likewise, if you think quantum mechanically, then we can put those two spins in into a singlet, but then it is impossible. Then we have one spin, Dongoli spin left, which means that we have degeneracy in the ground state. So if we generalize this picture to a network of triangular lattice, here we have a triangles. So here we have a triangular lattice. Then we can actually put randomly all those dimer coverings and add all those coverings up. So we get a new state. So obviously from the by construction, such a state doesn't break any symmetry because it's made of singlets, so it must be a singlet. And then because it's random dimer covering, so that means there is no symmetry, lattice symmetry breaking. So this is a state that is that preserves both the lattice symmetry and the spin rotational symmetry. And this, because it's made of those short singlets, so sometimes people call it a shorter range RVB state. So it is very much like a liquid state. So that's why people call it a spin liquid. So there are many interesting physical properties in a spin liquid state. So first of all, we have a global conservation law in the spin liquid state. So here we can, I think this can be explained by a simple example. So as I mentioned earlier, all the states are generated by random dimer coverings on the triangular lattice. And if you ask how we can move from one tunnel from one possible dimer covering to another, then so this can be done by all those local tunneling processes, known as local moves. So if you look at two triangles, then we have dimer coverings like this. And then by tunneling, we can go to another possible configuration. And so this is one of those local moves. The conservation law comes from the fact that we have comes from this. So if we have a torus instead of a plane or a flake, then we draw a line going across this torus, which has a non-trivial winding number, and we count the number of dimers cut through this this line. Then, so here we originally have three dimers cutting through this line, so the crossing number is three. But and then by virtue of the local move, we can go from this state to a next state. And we see that this crossing number is decreased by two. So we see that in these local moves, the parity of the crossing number is preserved. So that means that the whole Hilbert space of all those dimer coverings are decomposed into two subspaces. One has even numbers of dimers crossing this line, and the other has odd number here. Another has all number of dimers crossing this line. So those two subspaces never talk to each other, and any Hamiltonian built atop on this basis must commute with this quantity. So those two states are, those two subspaces sometimes are known as topological sectors. So far I've been talking about ground states, and excited states are also interesting. So it turns out here that the excited, so we know that in conventional magnets, the excited states are simply magnons, carry a spin 1 degrees of freedom. So it turns out that in spin liquid, we have a quite exotic excitations known as spinons. So spinons carry a spin 1/2 degrees of freedom. I think it can be, so how do we see that? So let's say we take a snapshot of a ground state. So this means we have a particular arrangement of those singlets on the triangular plane, and we want to create an excited state. So to do that, we just promote a singlet to a triplet, which means that we effectively have two spins. And I can move one of the spin around in the lattice and make them make those two spins separate as far as I wish. So that means those two, I really should think of those two spins as individual excitations. So by simple counting, we see that each spin carries spin 1/2 degrees of freedom. So this is quite different from the excitations in a conventional magnet. So sure, it's very nice to have such a state, but the question, the big question is where can we find a system where the ground state is a spin Nikoli state. So originally, Anderson proposed that the ground state of a spin 1/2 triangular Heisenberg anti-ferromagnet might be such a state. And he did some very simple numerical estimates. But turns out that he was wrong. The ground state of a triangular lattice is not really a spin Nikoli state. It's actually a 120 degrees state like this. So we have spins are pointing in three different directions on three different sublattices. So apparently, we don't have a spin Nikoli. So this has been confirmed by both numerics and also analytical calculations. So apparently, we don't have a spin Nikoli state on this simple model. But fortunately, there's another candidate model, which is known as spin 1/2 Kagome Heisenberg anti-ferromagnet. So in such a system, it seems that, so this model is basic, so this is the Kagome lattice. So we have a network of corner sharing triangles, and the Hamiltonian is very simple. We just put anti-ferromagnetic interaction between neighboring spins on each bound. So this Hamiltonian looks really innocuous, but turns out it's really a challenging problem. So computing the ground state of this, determining the ground state of this Hamiltonian is really a challenging problem. So this is just a partial list of all the kinds of proposals people managed to come up with in the past 20 years. So we have valence bound crystals, U1 Dirac spin Nikolis, and gap zeta spin Nikolis, and this list just goes on and on. But today but the good thing is that we have infinite many, so we have finite many number of proposals. So comparing to string theory where we have infinite many proposals, this list is still finite. So we can compare, for instance, energy and determine which proposal wins.
I think I forgot to turn.
Okay, so sorry about that. So today I'll be focusing the proposal from density reduced DMRG calculations, because so far DMRG provides the best ground state energy estimate. So I'll quickly give you a summary of what DMRG found in the ground state of a Kagome system. So first of all, they didn't find any signature of a symmetry breaking, so that's very promising. And they also found a quite large triplet gap. By triplet gap, I mean the energy for creating, promoting energy difference between the singular ground state and the triplet ground state. And also the correlation, spin-spin correlation length is quite short, is comparable to lattice size. And also people found a topological entanglement entropy and from which they determined the total quantum dimension is 2. So summarizing all of those from all those findings, it's very likely it seems that the ground state of the Kagome Heisenberg anti-ferromagnet is a Z2 spin Nikoli. But this is not all of the story, because there are also some mysteries from the numerical calculations. So I'll just mention two of them. So first thing is the so-called diamond resonance. So in the paper by Simon Yan, David Hughes, and Steve White, they want to examine in all of those resonances between different various dimer coverings, which particular dimer resonance process is most relevant. So to check that, what they did was they increased the exchange interaction on a given loop and examine the response from the in the ground state. So they found that the if the range So previously, people thought that the resonance around the hexagon is probably the dominant process. So you would expect if we increase the exchange interaction on this hexagon, we would have a very big response from ground state. And it turns out this is not the case. They found that actually the dominant resonant process is most likely from a diamond loop resonance processes. Because if you increase the exchange interaction on this diamond-shaped loop, they found a significant modulation in the ground state. If you compare the two, you can see this very clearly. And independently, this was also discovered by Diepenbrock and Schollerwijk in their paper by using a slightly different method. Another interesting thing they found in DMRG was the even odd effect. So we know that in DMRG, people generally take this cylindrical geometry where they wrap this two-dimensional plane into a quasi one-dimensional tube. So we know that from early on, we know that there is a Lieb-Schutz-Matisse theorem tells us that if the number of spins per unit cell, one-dimensional unit cell, is odd, then we'll either have gapless ground state or a symmetry breaking. So indeed, here they found something that is consistent with this LSM theorem. So for instance, this is a Kagome tube used by Steve White in his calculation. And if we count the number of spins for this particular unit cell for this particular tube, then there are 9 spins. So we know that there are either the ground state is gapless or there is symmetry breaking. So indeed, they found there is a symmetry breaking pattern. So here, the thick solid lines are places where the spin-spin correlation is enhanced, and those dashed lines are places where the spin-spin correlation is decreased. So the thickness of the band corresponds to the magnitude of modulation. So from this picture, we see that there's a curious zigzag and the stripy like patterns in the ground state. And why there's such a pattern, this is something that people didn't understand back then. So to summarize, so I have mentioned earlier that people in DMR, from DMRG, people didn't find any symmetry breaking, and there's a big triplet gap and short spin correlation, and also Z2 topological entanglement entropy. So all of the things, of course, are pointing to the universal properties of Z2 spin liquid. But there are also some properties that phenomena that the people didn't understand. So as I mentioned, there was the diamond resonance, and there was also this curious valence bound density wave pattern observed in the ground state on odd cylinders. So the question is whether we could explain those features from a phenomenological theory for this Z2 spin liquid. So the answer is yes. Actually, not only we could do that, actually we could say that those features are actually a positive evidence for a Z2 spin liquid, as you shall see soon. So from now on, I will talk about how we construct such a phenomenological theory and how we explain those features from DMRG. So the starting point of our construction is a very simple model, is the quantum dimer model. So the basic idea of a quantum dimer model is from the intuition of Phil Anderson. So as I mentioned earlier, that the intuitive picture for spin liquid is basically the resonating is basically a super is basically the resonance or tunneling processes between all of those singulate these dimer covering patterns. So here in the quantum dimer model, people assume that all of those dimer covering patterns form a no energy basis in the Hilbert space, and they simply try to minimize energy based on that. So the Hamiltonian for a quantum dimer model is basically all those local tunneling processes. For instance, one possible process could be a tunneling from this pattern on Davis star to its conjugate through some quantum tunneling process. But here I would say that I'm not going to derive a quantum dimer model from first principle. This is something that I'm not going to do. I just use quantum dimer model as a starting point for, as a guide for our construction. So in quantum dimer model, we have all of those dimer coverings as our basis. And it turns out that there is an intrinsic connection between quantum dimer model on Kagome lattice and Z2 gate theory on Holcomb lattice. So this is going to be this simple observation is actually vital for our construction. So how do we see such a correspondence? So first, the basic idea is that there is a very nice representation for dimer coverings on Kagome lattice. So this representation is known as arrow representation. So this is the basic idea. So if we take a triangle in a Kagome lattice, there are essentially two possibilities. One possibility is that it's covered by a singlet or a dimer, or it is simply empty. So if it is covered by a dimer, then we associate two incoming arrows and one outgoing arrow with this triangle. And the direction of this outgoing triangle arrow is perpendicular to this singlet. And on the other hand, if it is simply an empty triangle, then we associate three outgoing arrows with this triangle. So White Elser actually showed that there is a one-to-one correspondence between the dimer covering on the Kagome lattice and these arrow arrangements on the Holcomb lattice. Because we know that the arrows are actually living on the bounds of a Holcomb lattice. And of course, those arrows are not entirely independent. Those arrows are actually subject to a constraint. The constraint that on a given vertex of the Holcomb lattice, either we have three outgoing arrows or two coming incoming and one outgoing arrows. So this constraint can be translated into an algebraic equation. So to do this, we first map the arrows to first we define Ising variables on the bounds of Holcomb lattice, and we define that if the arrow is pointing, so because on Holcomb lattice we have A and B sublattices, and we define that if the arrow is pointing from A to B, then we associate number 1 to that bound. If it is from B to A, then we associate number minus 1. So then we know that the constraint that we must have odd number of outcoming arrows is simply translated to the product of those three Ising variables must be 1 if this side is A side, or minus 1 if it is B side. So if we take a slightly different point of view, if you think of those Ising variables are simply the electric fluxes defined on those bounds, then this constraint is simply a Z2 Gauss law. So this tells us that we have positive charge on A sublattice and a negative charge on the B sublattice. So you see the Hilbert space of the dimer coverings on Kagome lattice and the Hilbert space of this particular Z2 gate theory on the Holcomb lattice are identical. So any quantum dimer model on Kagome lattice can be reformulated as a lattice Z2 gate theory on Holcomb lattice. So this is, I would say this is different from all previous constructions because there the correspondence between dimer model and the Z2 gate theory is simply an approximation, but here this is exact. So okay, so let me remind you how this is done. So we start with a dimer covering, and then we use the arrow representation from White Elser. We draw arrow arrangements, and then from our mapping, we can think of this arrow arrangement as the electric flux configuration in a particular Z2 lattice gate theory. So this is the whole process. So okay, we have such a mapping, and the question is whether we can construct a Z2 spin liquid. So it turns out that there was a simple Hamiltonian, quantum dimer model Hamiltonian on Kagome lattice, which does realize a Z2 spin liquid. This was the famous Serbama-Pasquia Hamiltonian. So here, it turns out that this Hamiltonian has a very simple Z2 gate theory interpretation. So as I mentioned earlier, the dimer coverings can be translated into the electric fluxes, electric flux configurations. So I just defined the electric flux operators. The natural question is, how about those magnetic flux operators? So here we can define the link variables those sigma z's that are anti-commuting with the electric flux operators, and we can multiply all of those linked variables around a loop, and we have a z2 flux operator. So what this flux operator does on those dimers? So by looking at this construction, we see that every time we apply this flux operator on a hexagon, it changes the sign of all those electric fluxes on those bounds. So from this error representation, what it means that every time I apply this flux operator, it reverses the orientation of all those arrows, which means to bring one dimer configuration on this Davis star to its conjugate. So this is the operator simply permutes those dimers within a Davis star. And because this is a flux, and obviously this operator commutes with the charge operator as I defined earlier, so which means that this operator doesn't bring you outside of the Hilbert, the correct Hilbert space. And given this simple, flux operator, we can write down the simply possible Z2 Gauss theory Hamiltonian, which is the sum of all of those flux operators. And obviously, from Gauss theory perspective, this is a Z2 spin liquid. And what it does this wave function, does this state look like in a dimer basis? Well, it's easy, because in the ground state, this magnetic flux operator must be one, which means the ground state must be invariant under the action of this flux operator. So as I explained, the F operator, this flux operator permutes dimers. So that means the state must be invariant under dimer permutation. So that means the ground state must be the sum of all possible dimer coverings. So that is simply a Rokestad-Kivelsen state on Kagome. And that also, that we know that such a state does describe a Z2 spin liquid on Kagome. So this is very good. So we actually have a Hamiltonian that gives us a Z2 spin liquid as the ground state. But the question is whether it suffices as an effective theory, whether it could explain all those features observed in DMRG. The answer is no. The reason is very simple. So so first, let's see whether it does explain the reproduce the features observed in DMRG. So as a test, what we can do is that we can simply increase the exchange interaction on a given bound. And that would induce a dimer density pattern in the ground state. So basically, this is measuring the dimer-dimer correlation in the ground state. So this is what people found in DMRG. So they increased the exchange interaction by a little bit, and they see a very strong modulation in the neighborhood. So we can do the same thing for the Miss-Gauge Hamiltonian. And it turns out if we do this, the effect, this local modulation is limited to its close neighborhood. It doesn't go very far. So the reason is very simple. The reason is that the correlation length, the dimer-dimer correlation length in MS in the Miss-Gauge Hamiltonian is extremely short. It's just lattice scale. It has to do with the fact that the Weissong excitations in such a system in Miss-Gauge Hamiltonian are essentially static. They don't move at all. So that means the Miss-Gauge Hamiltonian is not enough to reproduce those DMRG features. So the natural thing to do, next step, is trying to modify the Miss-Gauge Hamiltonian a little bit, trying to add some perturbation and see whether it could work better. So we know from Z2 Gauss theory, we know that the most natural choice for introducing perturbation is simply add electric flux operator to the Hamiltonian. So that could bring in the fluctuations or bring the dynamics to those Weissong excitations. But it turns out that this is not allowed by the symmetry. The reason is very simple, because it has to do with the inversion symmetry in the Helicombe lattice. So we know, as I mentioned earlier, that let's say we have an arrow pointing from one vertex to another vertex, and the inversion symmetry demands that if we actually do the inversion transformation, the Hamiltonian must be invariant. However, the arrow directions is flipped, so that means all the odd powers of sigma x operators must be gone. So that means the linear term in sigma x is forbidden by the inversion symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So the next thing to do is to introduce bilinear terms. And after a simple analysis, you can see that actually the leading perturbation that is allowed by the symmetry is simply a third neighbor coupling between those electric flux operators. Yes? I don't have matter in this theory because it's a pure Z2 gauge theory.
But if you introduce it, does it mean nothing in the original model?
So far, it's not in the model. Yeah. So here you can think of that this works in the limit that the spin on gap is infinite. So the matter are effectively decoupled from the theory. So no energy fluctuations are just gauge fluctuations. Okay. So by third neighbor, I mean the interaction between those two bounds on opposite sides of this hexagon. So this is the leading perturbation that is allowed by symmetry. So we have two terms in the Hamiltonian. And here the sign of H is, at this stage, actually is not important. So let's simply assume it is positive. And the next question is, what is the sign of K? So it could be positive, could be negative. We don't know. So now this is a place that we need information input from DMRG. So in DMRG, people found that this kind of resonance around a diamond-shaped loop is important in the ground state. So how does it translate into a gauge theory? So again, we use this arrow representation, and those are this is the arrow precision for this state, and this is the conjugate. We see that in this process, the arrows on opposite ends of the hexagon are always opposite to each other, as you can see from, for instance, this one and that one have opposite directions, and this and that also have opposite directions. So that means the coupling constant K must be positive. So now we actually, from DMRG calculation, so now we're able to determine the sign of K. And because we just want a weak perturbation, so we can assume that the magnitude of K is very small compared to H. So we have a weakly coupled Z2 gauge theory. Again, this is very different from the previous constructions. For instance, the construction found by Moster and Sondi, because there the coupling is all, because they are always working in a strong coupled limit. Okay, so we have Z2 gauge theory, Hamiltonian, and because we know that the ratio between K and H simply changes the length scale in the ground state. So if we don't care about length scale, then basically we can set K to arbitrary number. And then this is, as far as qualitative features are concerned, this is fixed, yes. I simply add a term that favors a particular arrow arrangement. So as I mentioned earlier, the Daimler coverings are tied to the arrow arrangements. Further than is tied to electric flux configurations. Let's say on a given triangle, can you see it from here? So on a given triangle, if we have a Daimler sitting here, that means there must be three arrows in this particular configuration. So what I do is I simply add perturbations. So let's call it sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3. Then I simply add a term like this. That would favor this particular kind of NOCO arrow arrangement. So this is how I translate the enhancement of exchange interaction to this Z2 gauge theory. Okay. Yeah. So so we have a standard Z2 gauge theory Hamiltonian in the weak coupled limit. So this is a fairly standard model and can be solved by the standard duality technique. So we can go ahead and solve it and trying to compare our results with DMRG. So for experts, I'd like to mention a few words about the dual theory. So we know that as I said earlier, the Z2 gauge theory is defined on Helicon. That means the dual theory is defined on triangular lattice. So because the original gauge theory, the coupling is between third neighbors. So that means the dual theory, the coupling is also between the third neighbor dual Ising variables. So that means effectively, my triangular lattice is decomposed into four sublattices that don't talk to each other, at least in the quadratic level. So actually, this has to do with the underlying projective symmetry group. If you use the more conventional of the Parton construction approach. Okay, so yeah, as I asked earlier, whether we can reproduce those numerical results. So before we jump into comparison, I'd like to say a few more words about the topological sectors in this system. So as I mentioned, in the short range RVB state, the topological sector are defined by looking, examining the number of dimers crossing a given line, a given non-contractible loop in the underlying torus. So using gauge theory language is even simpler. So we have this honeycomb lattice, and we'll draw a line cutting through the system. And then we'll simply compute the product of those electric flux operators on those bounds that cross this cut. So you can see that this operator simply counts the total number of charge sitting at infinity in this cylindrical geometry, or in other words, simply measure the total electric flux going through this cylinder, and it commutes with the Hamiltonian, the gauge theory Hamiltonian. So, so it turns out that the even odd effect can be very easily understood from this little gauge theory perspective. So let's look at what happens in those even cylinders first. Remember, recall that even cylinder means there are even number of spins per one dimensional unit cell. So this is an example of one even cylinder. So this is my unit cell, and it has eight sites, so that's even. So recall that the definition of total electric flux operator, or this X, actually depends on the cut. So which cut I choose in the cylinder. So here, so we do have some arbitrariness here. So for instance, I can choose a cut cutting through the cylinder like this. So that means I need to multiply the electric flux operators on those red bounds. And I can do something slightly different. I can go to choose another cut and then define another operator X prime associated with those bounds. Okay, so now we have two operators, X and X prime. So we know that from our construction, there are positive charge on these red sides and the negative charge on those black sides. But so that means the X and X prime are related by Gauss law. So if you simply count the total number of charge, which is one, so that means that X and X prime must equal. On the other hand, X and X prime are related by simply a translation operation in the cylinder. So from this observation, we see that the translation operator and the total electric flux operator commute for even cylinder. That is good. That means we can find a ground state which has well-defined total electric flux, and also it does preserve the translational symmetry. But the situation is entirely different if we go to all the cylinders. So this is an example of all cylinders. In all cylinders, we have total charge minus one in the unit cell. So if we use the same setup, that means X must equal minus X prime from Gauss law. Again, X and X prime are related by translational symmetry. So that means the translational operator and the total electric flux operator, they don't commute. They actually anti-commute. So that means there must be a ground state degeneracy, because both translation and X commutes with the Hamiltonian itself. So if we choose a basis where the ground state carries well-defined total electric flux, or stay in a well-defined topological sector, that must break the translational symmetry in some way. So from this little gauge theory translation, we can easily understand the even odd effect. So this is purely based on symmetry. We can actually compare the symmetry breaking patterns in the ground state from our theory with the DMRG. So this is a symmetry breaking pattern observed in DMRG. And this is, as I mentioned earlier, this is an odd cylinder. And it has this stripy partons or density wave partons in the ground state. The notation is the same. So the thick lines means we have enhanced spin-spin correlation, and dashed lines means we have weakened spin-spin correlation. The magnitude of the modulation is represented by the width of the line. So here we use the same notation. So if you compare those two, you can see that they are almost identical. And likewise, we can choose, because there are infinite many of ways to wrap up a two-dimensional plane into a cylinder. So we can choose something different. So for instance, we can add a twist when we wrap up the cylinder. So we have a chiral tube. So this is the ground state symmetric breaking pattern observed in a ground state on a chiral tube. And here, this is our result from in the same symmetry. If you compare the two, you see also the two agree very well. Yes, please. Yes, that's a very good question. So K actually only affects the length scale. And also, so here, it actually just affects the absolute magnitude of this modulation, the strength of modulation. So here, because I just care about the qualitative comparison, so for instance, those general features, so I simply take K to any value. Yeah, I can imagine that it would be hard to really reproduce all the details from DMRG. Does it answer your question? At large K, I drive you to a valence bond crystal phase. So if K is big, we enter a confined phase. So here is actually a valence bond crystal.
So yeah. Large,
right, but here I'm sitting very, very far away from that transition. So this is the comparison in the ground state on all cylinders. So we can do other comparisons. As I mentioned earlier, in the numerics, we can enhance the exchange interaction and see the dimer partons induced by such a modulation. And we can do the same thing in the ground state. So if you compare the two, you can also see that the two agree very well. Now, if you want to change K, what happens is that actually changes the range of effects from this modulation. Basically, you are changing the length scale in the system. So you can tune the K in such a way that the length scale in the numerics and length scale from the theory agree. So there are some interesting features here, actually. So if you look at the numerical results very carefully, you can see that there are diamond-shaped loops where the spin correlation is enhanced. And there are also diamond loops where the spin-spin correlation is weakened. So and those enhanced and weakened diamonds are actually alternating in this in the lattice. So here I show them as plus and minus signs. So in our theory, we actually reproduce the same kind of alteration. And I also would like to mention that if you use large-scale exact diagonalization on 48 sites cluster, you can also see similar patterns in the modulation. So that means this is really a physical effect there. Finally, I would like to say a few things about the spin-ons. So to understand spin-ons, let's go back to the discussion about topological sectors. So as I mentioned earlier, for each cylinder, we have two subspaces, each one associated with a well-defined electric flux going through the system. So we can compute the ground state energy in each subsector and compare them. So this is a plot showing the ground state energy as a function of the circumference of the cylinders. So you can see there's an interesting alternating pattern there. So when the circumference, so here I follow the notation of Steve White. So the 4m simply means the length of the circumference, m must be an integer. So when m is 2, 4, 6, we see that the ground state lies in the even sector. So that means the total flux is 1. However, if you go to, if m is 3 or 5 or 7, then the ground state has minus 1 total electric flux going through the cylinder. So as I gradually increase the circumference, then the ground state sector actually alternates between even and odd. So this is a feature that is related to this bilinear coupling. And so now we know that in the bulk, from energetics, we always have a well-defined total electric flux or topological sector. But the historic situation could be different if we have a, say, half infinite cylinder. Because on the edge always pins a particular dimer covering. that would translate into a particular electric flux arrangement. And from this electric flux arrangement, we can also compute the total electric flux. So that means on the edge, we can also define a topological sector, so or total electric flux. So I simply call it edge sector. So this is a particular zigzag-shaped boundary chosen by Steve White and his collaborators. So in this particular boundary, we have arrows going in opposite direction as you move along. So if you compute the total electric flux on the edge, then turns out that it's simply minus 1 to the power of m, and m is this index. As I mentioned earlier, we have also an alteration in the ground state. So that means the bulk energetics selects also this minus 1 to the power of m sector. So that means the edge sector and the bulk sector always agree. So I mean, that's fine. So we don't have any problem or trouble. However, if we choose a different boundary condition, the story could be different. So this is another type of boundary condition chosen by other people, like Hongchen Jiang's group, Hong Jiang's calculation. So this is a uniform boundary condition. So in this uniform boundary condition, we have this uniform, it pins a uniform dimer covering. And then the electric flux always coming out or pointing to the left by my definition. So if you compute the total electric flux, we can see that it's always going to be 1, no matter what the index number is. So then we see, immediately see that if m itself is an odd number, there's a problem. Because in the bulk, energetic selects minus 1 sector, but on the edge, we have 1 sector. So that means, so how to resolve this contradiction? To resolve a contradiction, we simply introduce a spinon sitting at the edge. So this spinon could screen the electric flux coming from the bulk. So that make the whole thing sensible. So this is very similar to, say, screening of electric field in a normal metal, because there you apply electric field to a metal, then we'll have lots of electrons coming from the bulk to screen the electric field from outside. So this is, in a sense, similar to that. And you can also look at the energy cost for inserting a spinon at a given position. And you can easily see that it grows linearly as a function of distance, as a function of location of the spinon. So that means the spinon is always bound to the edge. So so you can see that from this simple theory, we can also predict that in certain circumstances, we can also observe edge spinons in the ground state. So, yes.
Since you started with the strong valence bond, this object which you call a spinon could be something else also.
It could be something else, but yeah, I agree. But I think the most natural choice would be a monomer. Mm-hmm. It's a defect in the dimer covering. So that's what I mean by a spinon. That's a very good question, because if you put the spinon here, then we can look at the arrangement. So here we have this plus 1 sector, and in the bulk we have minus 1 sector as demanded by energy. So then the energy cost for this thing is simply the energy density for this plus 1 sector minus energy density for minus 1 sector. This is always a constant.
But in the large cylinder limit,
In a wide cylinder limit, yes. If it is infinitely wide, yes. So finally, I'd like to make a summary of what I found. So again, I use this Steve White notation. M is, so somehow I use n. So n is the index. So it characterizes the circumference of the cylinder. So depending on the number modulo 4, you could have 4 different kinds of ground state. So if it is 0, then we have uniform ground state, and there is no edge spinon. And there is only the ground state edge sector lies in this plus 1 sector. And if we make an analogy to one-dimensional spin chain physics, this looks like a trivial phase. And if it is modulo 4 by 1, we have a symmetry breaking. And there's, again, no spinons. But the ground state sector are the ground states are degenerate, could be plus or minus 1. So this is analogous to Majumdar-Gauss chain. And interestingly, if this is 2, the number is 2, then we have a uniform ground state, but also it has edge spin on a finite cylinder. And the ground state sector is in -1. So this is similar to a Haldane phase. And for 3, then it's pretty much like the case for M module 4 equals 1. So as we proceed, then we actually are exploring this periodic table. So to summarize, so I have built up a phenomenological theory for the Z2 spin liquid in the Kagome. And this theory is strongly constrained by lattice symmetry. And we can explain some features observed from DMRG. And we also made some predictions that could be checked by a DMRG calculation. And also, I'd like to do a few open problems. For instance, so far, our construction doesn't really point out which particular Z2 spin liquid is in the ground state. So we know that the spin liquid is, so here, if we just focus on Z2, then it is a Z2 topological phase that is enriched by both spin rotational symmetry and lattice symmetries. So if you focus on near the shorter range RVB states, then we actually know that there are 4 possible RVB states, 4 fundamentally different RVB states, depending on the flux patterns in the Davis star. And it turns out if you really carry out numerical calculation for all of them, they all show gapped behavior and a very short spin-spin correlation. So because our theory essentially just predicts the dimer-dimer correlation and dimer density, so it doesn't really distinguish those 4 different states. So an open question is, how do we determine those 4 or distinguish those 4 states from DMRG-like calculations, or whether we could come up with methods that really tell the difference? You mean H or sorry?
The
coupling between the.
There's a sign of the loop operator.
Oh, that's H, yes.
That's H. Okay, mm-hmm. So H is a positive, then that looks like the pipe lock.
Yes, that's right.
The pipe lock looks like that's a lock
of. Right, so actually.
The middle 2 is a pipe lock. The middle 2 is a pipe lock.
Mm-hmm.
And the first and the fourth one is the uniform.
Okay. Actually, so if we just measure dimer correlation function, then it actually turns out the sign of H doesn't matter because remember it's always due to some eigentheory, and we have this, we can always flip
but
the
wave function that matters, I wonder. I think that it's the sign of H determines the pipe flux or the
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
At
least in some other theories.
Okay.
And if one makes this correspondence between the sign of H and the flux, then looks like the thick middle.
I see.
But that's probably can be seen from the wave function. You compare the phase wave function of adding a loop and not adding a loop. There's a minus sign, just since the H in the sign, so there's a sign.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this first, and the middle 2 and the last 2 may be different.
Okay.
Just a related comment. Can't you think of them as Weissmann condensation, starting from some reference state,
mm-hmm.
say 0 flux state,
mm-hmm.
you tune some parameters and Weissmann energies come down, and you condense them in different patterns.
That might work, but I guess it also depends on the interactions in between those dimers. So it might be more sensitive to the energetics in the Hamiltonian, but I think the difference between all those states, even without Hamiltonian, they are.
But from the Kagome like study,
mm-hmm.
which one is preferred from the spin problem? Is it possible to see?
Actually, I don't know. So, because I don't know how to construct. So those actually are defined, well defined, say for RK state. So, but we know that our case, they don't give us good energetics. So it's hard to tell at this moment, but maybe in future people could really do the calculation and see which one is favored by energy. So, I'd also briefly mention that another problem is that whether we can actually, so as was brought up earlier, So in my theory, there is no spin-on. So I take the limit that spin gap goes to infinity, and the matter is effectively decoupled from the gauge fluctuation. But we know that in reality, they are there. So how do we actually add those fermionic? So how do we add those spin-ons back to the theory? How do we actually construct them? Actually, there was earlier work from our group. I think Jihao was sitting in the audience. So he showed that the spin-ons are actually a fermionic. So the question then becomes, how do we add fermionic spin-ons to couple them to the two gauge fluctuations? I guess that will be all. Thank you. How to stabilize them in DMRJ. So basically you're asking which quantum dimer Hamiltonian gives us such a state.
Or looking, you know what the answer is in the quantum dimer model where you assume that. Going backwards, you just have to guess with some sense of what kind of job it's stabilized.
Well, I claim that this is basically the state observed in DMRG. So we don't need to do any tuning. If you take Heisenberg model, this is it.
No, but I'm saying one, if you wish a prediction,
mm-hmm.
if this is true, then you would predict certain terms would stabilize this state.
You mean further stabilize this state?
Yeah.
Well, I can imagine certain Rin exchange type interactions could probably stabilize this state, for instance, inspired by this Diamond loop resonance process. And also I heard from people, from DMRG people, that if you increase next neighbor exchange interaction, you can also stabilize the Z2 phase. But that I don't know the details. I just heard from numerics. Yeah.
So in your periodic table, you mentioned the X, so in your diamond model, there's no X.
In my Dimer model, there is a SU2 symmetry. I mean, it acts trivially on those objects, but it is there.
Yeah, it's curious. So what's the meaning of?
The meaning of a spin-on in the Dimer model is simply a monomer. So instead of having a dimer, I break a dimer into two halves. I have two monomers moving around. So that is the picture for a spin-on in the Dimer model.
Yeah, so you see in the 1D analog, it's like a Hollandian phase. So the Hollandian phase usually we require this.
Yes, I mean, I agree. This is really a broad analogy. It's not really, you know, there's not really a one-to-one correspondence microscopically. The meaning is that, well, here I'm just saying that the phenomena displayed by this particular Kagome tube looks similar to what people observe in Haldane phase.
You mean there's something like real mode on the edge?
Yes. It's not protected by local symmetry, I agree. But I guess that might be a lattice symmetry is important in this case. So maybe that the lattice symmetry in the Kagome, because we wrap up the lattice into a tube, so the lattice symmetry might be important, particularly if you rotate the tube, then might actually... translation or, yeah, might be relevant. But I don't know, I don't know for sure that this is the case, but this is just my guess. They could. This is actually a very solid prediction. So what we claim is that if you take a uniform boundary condition like this, and you go to a cylinder, say, with m equals to 3, you will see if you go to a spin 1, if you select spin 1 ground state, you will see a magnetization on left and the right edges of the Kagome cylinder. And if you measure them, the total number should be 1 half and 1 half. So if you go to spin 0, then you'll see 1 half and minus 1 half. So that is the claim.
Yeah, but Lisa, you mentioned that the new model you have four star lattice.
Yes.
But that means you have several independent equal big series.
Ah, that's a very good question. The four are independent at the quadratic level. So let's say because the only thing that protects us is this in the dual construction is this projective symmetry. So actually, it turns out that if you go to quartic level, they could be recoupled. But it's recoupled in a very strange way.
Yeah, but the concern is that the 4Z2 model is a stable point. So a perturbation of that would still give you a 4Z2 independently good gate state. So the issue is that one needs a strong enough coupling to make all the input to one input. So there's an issue whether this model prefers to have a full independent input gate theory or have only single input gate theory. I think
that is a
theory is kind of stable.
you mean this for Gaussian?
No, not Gaussian. You can start with a little gate theory defined on each of the
and you add interactions.
And then that back is a the phase. Then
okay.
A small interaction is a 4D2 phase is stable.
Actually, I'm
strong enough interaction is 4D2 may maybe three of these get combined, only one survives. So you need a strong interaction to drive combined condition to get from 4D2 to 1D2.
I'm not sure about that because such if students consider maybe from different contexts but consider this problem. So the consider the from a slightly different construction, they consider the dual Ising theory and identify the symmetry group as such, and they ask the question, what is the phase diagram for such a theory? So they perform RG analysis. And turns out that the once you add interaction that is allowed by that symmetry, the theory always seems that a theory always flow to some strong couple point limit. So they couldn't identify a second order transition. So there's no Wilson loop, Wilson Fischer fixed point in that theory. At least at the one loop or two loop levels. So. I mean, if there are four independent theories, then we should be able to identify a critical point that is associated with. Yes. So, for instance, the D talks to D, and there will be.
If you don't have a coupling between D and D, then that's different story.
The thing is that.
I think what you say the four sub-latin means at the quadratic level.
Yes.
Only D talks to D.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
So that looks like you have four independent.
Right. That's what system. That's what I mean.
That's suggesting four independent D2. That's why.
Right. That's what I mean. But turns out that it could be coupled if you go to quartic level. So
if quartic level is weak, then you may still have four D2. That's an issue. But it's not controlled calculation, so it depends whether quartic level is strong or weak.
Yes. So I think at least perturbatively, if you take the quartic interaction as weak, then their RG analysis show that they always flow to. So basically mean that there's no weak couple limit. But maybe we should check their calculation. But yeah.
How about the spin up? Suppose you introduce some rich charge.
That's a good question. I don't know. And this is something that I'm trying to do. But
do you have some kind of argument that the coupling between ABCD is the coupling acquired
for that? If you add spin ons? I don't know. I don't know. This is, as I said, this is something that I'm trying to do. But
it's not clear whether this is the covenant acquired for them is bisymmetry or bisymmetry.
It's actually bisymmetry. If you look at this particular symmetry, turns out that they carry a four-dimensional irreducible representation for this GL to Z3. Yeah, so that's why. So in other words, the only bilinear that is allowed by this symmetry is simply the sum of those four theories squared. However, if you go to quartic, there are two possible invariant polynomials. One is this O4 symmetric term. Another is a highly exotic strange polynomial of those four variables. So it has to do with some strange, some high dimensional polyhedra in four dimensional space.
And a lot of excitations in the original Kawome spin system as well as the newer system.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a gap for singlet excitations?
That's a very good question. I don't think this issue is really settled numerically. So in Steele-White's paper, they did measure the singlet gap, and they found that even though they are finite, but there is no good scaling for them. I don't know whether people actually done any scaling for
it.
But in my model, they are definitely gapped. This is actually, yeah. So let's say if it turns out that numerics found that the singular is gapless, then this means that my theory is ruled out.
Yeah, just on the plot where you showed these ground states alternating, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Circumferences of steps four, is that right?
Yes.
What was the reason for that again?
The reason is that if those guys are, so first of all, those two cases corresponding to odd cylinders. So from our analysis, we know that there must be symmetry breaking the ground states. And those two are both even, so we should have uniform ground state. But from a detailed analysis on the edge physics, we know that this one corresponds to a state with edge spin. So that distinguished the two. So that's why we have this parallelogram table.
Uh-huh. So when you were showing him in steps of four, you were just focusing on edge.
Actually, the theory doesn't depend on the real number, which number I use. So this is entirely generic.
No, but I mean, just why, you know, why you chose to show the degeneracy, mm-hmm, the positive degeneracy, mm-hmm, and
that actually doesn't depend on the the number, which number I choose. It just depends on the counting. So, yeah, it should be robust.
Okay, so let's.